Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the program. My name is William Hemsworth. It's great to be with you all today. I'm excited to have our guest today. Our guest today is Pat Flynn. He's a writer, philosopher, podcaster, and speaker who lives in Wisconsin with his wife, five children, and St. Bernard. He hosts Philosophy for the People and the Pat Flynn Show, and his website is chroniclesofstrength.com. Pat, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm doing real good today. William, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. It's a great day here in Tucson. It's all good. Good Saturday. I enjoy my Saturdays because I get to talk to great people like you and just learn more about different things. So that's fun for me. So I love it.
Yeah. Well, that's very kind. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So you recently released a book called The Best Argument for God through Sophia Press. And I got this book in the mail and I was pretty excited to go through it. What inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, good question. An important question. So for many years, I would have considered myself a philosophical naturalist, and naturalism is really just a philosophically developed form of atheism. And I was fairly convinced of that position, but I was also considerably ignorant of the alternative or the alternatives, if you will, right? So I was, for just quick background, I was baptized Catholic, but I had no real religious formation or upbringing. My upbringing was about as secular as it gets. So when I was fairly young, in fact, I remember exactly when it was, around the sixth grade, I was sort of hit simultaneously with the two most, I think, relevant objections to the existence of God. Now, in the sixth grade, this will date me a little bit. For me, that was when 9/11 happened. And we watched it. We watched it happen on the little news station that we had in the classroom at the time. So pretty crazy, terrifying stuff. But hello, problem of evil, right? Like sort of right in your face with that. Around that time in the sixth grade, got the sort of basic middle school, explanation of the origins of the universe and Big Bang cosmology and stuff like that. So again, even though I had no deep, catechesis or religious formation, I was sort of faced with those two perennial, I think they are perennial, objections to belief in God or religious faith. One being the objection that, hey, we can, science has got this, right? We don't need God to explain anything, right? We can just appeal to the principles of nature. The principles of nature are enough. And in fact, that's one of the objections that Aquinas himself considers against the existence of God. And the other one, of course, probably more familiar to people, is, hey, if God exists and God is perfect, we have this perfect foundation to the world, then why is there so many negative states of affairs, so many awful things that happen in this world, the problem of evil, right? So at the time, it's not like I threw my hands up and was like, oh, that's it, I'm an atheist. I really wasn't thinking about it and from that perspective. But those planted significant seeds of doubt concerning whatever slim faith I had or orientation, religious orientation I had at the time, that would develop over time, that once I became much more interested in philosophy as a serious thing, as a serious discipline by late high school and then certainly by college, I was really sort of already veering in that naturalistic or atheistic direction. And I spent a lot of time there. But as it happens, William, I'm sort of your, I don't know, cliche story that, is a little bit of philosophy will bring you away from God. And if you keep going, more philosophy will eventually bring you back to him. And that was the case for me, right? So it wasn't like I encountered any like amazing arguments for God or anything right away. Really, it was a series of problems that I encountered through my own just investigations and explorations of naturalism, problems concerning explanatory power or comprehensiveness. I just gradually came to see that the promises of naturalism were pretty much all false, right? Like you really can't explain everything that needs to be explained from a sort of reductive, materialistic, atheistic worldview. Things like, well, why does anything exist at all? Or why does anything contingent exist at all instead of nothing? Or how do we make sense of human consciousness, or not just consciousness, but human rationality? How do we make sense of the moral landscape, the objective moral landscape, which certainly seems to be a real dimension of reality? How do we make sense of order, stability, fine-tuning, and indeed suffering and evil? Like, is it more expected? Is it better anticipated by the naturalistic worldview that we would actually have these types of evils or this distribution of suffering if we're starting from a principle of utter indifference versus a principle of pure perfection, which theists hold? And I think upon deep reflection, the answer to that is actually no, as I argue in my book. So to condense the story a little bit, there was just a point where I just sort of threw my hands up and said, I don't know what's true, but I don't think this naturalism system is it, right? And at that point, I began to just try to look at alternatives. I went back to some of the great pagan philosophers, eventually stumbled upon the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, and really started to find arguments for the existence of God that I thought were minimally interesting, and some of them quite convincing, in fact. Made a long study of that, eventually found myself calling myself a theist, a philosophical theist, very inclined towards classical theism. And you hang around Thomas for a while, and people who follow the footsteps of St. Thomas Aquinas, you get enough theology that you begin to wonder, you know, whether that stuff might be true as well, and start to investigate the claims of Christianity and Catholicism. And, well, people can connect the dots from there. So here I am on your podcast, right? Yeah.
All right. Great. Now, talking about naturalism, in your book, you discuss the conspiracy of naturalism, but you also, within that chapter, you have some confirmatory evidences for God. Can you explain some of those for us?
Yeah. So the primary thrust of my book, because it's called The Best Argument for God. Yeah. I'll back up a little bit. People sometimes think, well, what is that? Sure. Is that like Aquinas' first way or something? And no, that's not really what I'm up to. What I'm up to in this book is I'm first considering what I think is an interesting and somewhat serious argument for naturalism. And that is, if two theories explain just as much, believe the simpler theory. But naturalism and theism explain just as much, or so somebody might claim. However, naturalism is simpler, so believe naturalism. And in fact, this is kind of the objection that Aquinas considers when he's talking about how we could just appeal to the principles of nature. We don't need God to explain anything. So it's an objection with ancient roots, but the way I stated it is a more contemporary version. And what I'm saying is actually, no, this is totally wrong, right? If two theories explain just as much, believe the simpler. Okay, I don't have a huge problem with that commitment. However, what I really claim, what I argue for throughout the whole book, is that naturalism can only explain some, but not all of what theism can, but only when strapped with far greater complexity. So believe theism. And then what that lets me really do, William, is it allows me to make a cumulative case where now I can say, hey, look at all this stuff, these broad features of reality, these large-scale features of reality that a philosophical system or a worldview, a sort of big picture of everything, has to explain. Things like, why are there contingent things, things that exist but need not exist? There's nothing about their essence or nature that demands that they exist. Why is there so much order and stability in the world, or fine-tuning? Why do we have this experience, this moral experience of moral values and obligations? What's a good story we can tell about that, right? Suffering, evil, and so on and so forth, right? Things that we believe that a philosophical system needs to give a good story about all these features of reality. And then what I do is, you know, kind of section by section or chapter by chapter, as I look at these different, you know, call them phenomena or data points, and compare what I think is the best theistic explanation versus the best naturalistic explanation. And in some cases, I argue there is no conceivable naturalistic explanation. Only a classical theist paradigm can cover this data, right? In other cases, I may concede that there's some, you know, kind of naturalistic explanation, but the theistic one is far more robust, and it's ultimately a simpler explanation at the end of the day. And for naturalism to kind of keep up, that you brought up the conspiracy of naturalism in the explanatory race, where it hasn't been completely eliminated right out of the gate, it sort of has to adopt a lot of, you know, additional components. It has to become very ad hoc and contrived, like a conspiracy theory. So, you know, why do we reject conspiracy theories, like the large grand scale conspiracy theories, right? Some conspiracies are true, like people do rob banks and stuff, right? But those big conspiracy theories, why do we, even without investigating them so much, reject them? But we feel we're rational to reject them. And the answer actually has to do a lot with probability theory. And the idea is something like this, right? That these grand scale conspiracy theories seem to have so many basic components, so many moving parts, where things, so many things could just go wrong from the initial commitments of that theory, that they just seem internally so improbable, right? Just from the get-go. And that's why we don't feel like we have to, you know, refute every aspect of it, because it's just the intrinsic likelihood, given the initial complexity of conspiracy theories to cover the entire range of data, it just puts it out of the realm of believability for us. So we are rational to reject a lot of these things, right? Doesn't mean they're completely impossible, but they're sort of, you know, internal likelihood or probability is so low that it just it, they're not worth taking seriously. And I
Mm-hmm.
argue that if naturalism is at all going to have a chance to kind of keep up in the explanatory game with respect to some phenomena, it sort of has to wire itself with so much extra complexity that it just becomes so inherently unbelievable, like a sort of grand metaphysical conspiracy theory. Sorry, I don't even know if that answered your question, but that's what I gave. So we'll just go with it, right?
All right, sounds good. Now, when you were talking about your story, you mentioned the problem of evil, especially when it came up with 9/11 and everything. And that's an objection we hear quite a bit about. What would be the best way to answer that question? I guess to even point to the existence of God.
Yeah, this is a big thing, right? So, I mean, it could have many conversations on this. So just always
Sure.
like to say that whatever I say here will probably almost certainly not be adequate, but hopefully it starts pointing people in the right, what I think is the right direction. So there's different kinds of problems of evil. And when it comes to a philosophical inquiry, right, you have what might be called logical problems of evil and a logical or logical arguments from evil. And a logical argument is meant to show that there's some sort of like inconsistency within a philosophical worldview, within the commitments of that philosophical worldview, right? There's something sort of contradictory there, so it just can't be true, right? If you think that there can't be contradictions, which I think is right. Or there's some incompatibility between the commitments of a worldview and some obvious, undeniable fact of the world, say, right? And so a logical problem of evil is what it's proposing is that you have the latter sort of case, right? You have this commitment within the classical theistic worldview where you have this being that's perfectly good, right? God. And no theist would deny that God is perfectly good. Otherwise, we're not talking about God. And then you have this undeniable fact of experience of all these negative states of affairs, right? And what the skeptic is saying is that these things can't go together, right? It's like a square circle, right? And what they do is they propose various principles that are supposed to make the connection, the necessary connection that if you have the negative states of affairs and you can't have God, right? And they propose different principles, usually moral principles that are supposed to allow you to make that inference, right? And the general thing with logical arguments is they're hard to cash out, right? Because all the theist really needs to do is just have some other statement that's consistent that shows that the existence of God is no longer inconsistent with negative states of the world. And that's not hard to do, because you can just say that God has some morally worthy end that he's aiming for, that provides God justifying reasons for allowing these negative states of affairs. And even if we have no idea what that is, the burden is on the skeptic, since they're advancing the argument, to rule out that possibility. And I don't think that that's a burden that has ever been shouldered by the skeptic, right? There's a lot of other responses you can give to the logical problem of evil, but I think that that's pretty sufficient. And not only that, but most, or at least a lot of professional atheistic philosophers concede that. They concede that there are no, for example, there's a very smart atheistic philosopher named Graham Oppy. He's in print saying there is no successful logical problem of evil currently. Maybe there will be one in the future, but there's just not there. So that's, I don't think that that is a huge concern for people or theists right now. More interesting is what might be called the evidential problem of evil. And the idea here is this skeptic might say, okay, maybe there isn't a strict incompatibility between all the negative states of affairs of the world and God. However, it just seems like all the bad stuff in the world just counts as evidence against the existence of God. It makes God's existence less likely or very unlikely. Why? Because it's not the sort of world we would expect if God exists, but it does seem to be the sort of world that exists if naturalism is true, right? Because if naturalism is run by a principle of indifference and we're just kind of looking to explain things through some combination of atomic and evolutionary theory, and you have natural selection and, you know, this kind of fight for survival, well, then it just seems like, yeah, a whole bunch of sort of wanton suffering is kind of makes sense, right? It's so my system as a naturalist kind of predicts or anticipates this world, at least with its suffering, right? And the theist one doesn't really seem to do that, right? Maybe would expect things to be a bit better if God existed, right? Okay, so that's a more interesting challenge, I think. But we can challenge that challenge. I think we can challenge it very considerably. And there's really two ways of doing that. One is a defensive maneuver, and one is an offensive maneuver. And I do both in my book. A defensive maneuver is to offer some sort of theodicy. And a theodicy is a story that we tell where we're trying to draw out the consequences of this sort of fundamental theistic theory to show that actually, as it happens, when we really understand this theory better and the principles internal to that theory, this world, including with all of its suffering and evil, is actually not all that surprising whatsoever. We probably don't have time to go into all of that now, but I use a lot of different principles like the good is self-diffusive, why God would create a great hierarchy of beings, a great chain of being, why metaphysically we're beings of a sort of fallible libertarian freedom, principles of God's governance, how he governs things according to their nature. So even if he could miraculously always cause us to choose the right thing, there's principles that align with God's wisdom of why he wouldn't do that, because God works to save natures, not destroy them, right? So he's always guiding us towards our end, which is himself in accord with our nature, which permits moral failure and fallibility, including with the angels and demons, right? Which play a role in the unfurling of creation. So there's a lot you can say about them and how, you know, they can get their, you know, proverbial hands into the mix of things and cause all sorts of trouble. I think when you spell all of that out, you actually have a pretty rich story that gets God sort of off the moral hook. Not only that, but actually gives you a pretty decent anticipation of a world like ours, even with what often seems like gratuitous suffering and evil. I think you actually can give a theistic story to show that this isn't all that surprising after all. When it comes to the naturalistic side, I think we have to dive a little bit deeper into the theory, but we can begin to expose that sort of the reverse is the case, where maybe initially or superficially you think that naturalism makes sense of suffering and evil, but once you go a little bit deeper, once you go substantially into the theory, you actually realize that it doesn't make any sense of it at all. So this is a little bit of a technical point, but let me try and draw it out. So naturalists, sure, again, are broadly, not all of them, but broadly are committed to this idea of what's called source physicalism. And what they believe is that the sort of physical realm precedes and causes the mental realm, whatever the mental realm is, a sort of qualitative conscious experience we have, right? It's latent local. It's produced by, it's fobbed off by the sort of physical interactions underneath, right? Okay. Now, there's a whole host of issues with that view, and I consider that in my section on philosophy of mind, but this is, you know, I think it's a general naturalistic view. I think it's also the consistent one, right? This is what a naturalist should be saying. Okay, but this relates to the problem of evil for several reasons, and one concerns an issue known as epiphenomenalism. Now, that's a chewy word, but an epiphenomena is really just something that is itself caused but causes nothing, right? So for a naturalist, the mental realm, the qualitative what it is likeness realm of our experience is something that is caused by physical interactions, but has no influence back down on the physical states of affairs, if that makes sense. It's sort of like a foam that just sort of floats atop of the ocean, right? Now, once you realize that's the case, all right, now we have a host of incredible questions and coincidences, because fundamentally, if you're telling me that the mental has no influence on the physical, then we have a very interesting question of why is it even there to begin with? What sort of functional role that has actually served to play, let alone a functional role for survival, right? So why is it there at all? Is it even if it could be there on naturalism, which I don't think it can be, there's no reason why it would be, even if it could be, okay? Going further than that, even if it is there, there's no reason that it has to be any particular type of experience, because what the experience is or what it is like has no functional or causal relevance on what your joints are doing, right? Now, once you realize that this disconnect is there, you no longer have really an evolutionary explanation for suffering, because as long as the physical interactions or states are appropriately selected for, it doesn't matter what the experience is like. So, for example, I could prick my hand on a pin and pull my hand away, but there's no reason that I need to feel pain when that happens, because the feeling has nothing to do with the actual physical states of affairs or interactions. I could just have the feeling that I have whenever I hear the Barney theme song, whenever I touch a pin. It doesn't matter, right? Now, this is kind of a subtle in the weeds point, but this is where you have to go to really evaluate worldviews to see, like, do you actually have an explanation here? And what I argue is no. Once you get under the hood of naturalism and you see like what's going on in a naturalistic worldview, you have all these big issues especially in philosophy of mind, issues that are sometimes known as the hard problem of consciousness or qualitative experience, but they're directly relevant to the types of explanations naturalists try to give when it comes to suffering and evil. What we need is an explanation for suffering, and suffering is something that's relevant to conscious beings and the experiences we have. And what I've shown is there's a major disconnect in the naturalistic worldview that now severs any adequate explanation of why we have these types of experiences at all, let alone the distribution that we have for them. So drawing that out in much more detail in my book, I actually argue, no, naturalism does not have at all any sort of adequate explanation for why we suffer at all, or why suffering is distributed in a way that it does. So that even if you think that the theistic explanation I gave is not great, maybe you think it's still unlikely, the naturalistic one is way worse. Even if you think the theistic one is bad, that's not the worst thing in the world, because it's the ratio that matters, right? If we're just between these two, it's better to go with a theory that's bad if there's one that's even worse, right? So it's not even like the theist one even needs a great. I think we can give a pretty good story on the theistic side, but even if you don't think that, comparatively, the naturalistic one is so much worse once you get into the actual weeds of it. So I hope that made sense. It's a big subject, but I'm trying to get at least the SparkNotes version out for your listeners. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, totally understand. So what feedback have you received from your book so far?
Yeah, well, amazingly, even from many of my atheistic friends, I tend to be very friendly and engage a lot with atheists. A lot of really good feedback so far. So I'm very happy to have seen, to my surprise, because this book is a philosophy book, right? It's not apologists will be interested in it, but it is properly a book in philosophy of religion, so it's kind of a small, I guess, circle of people that it's aimed towards. But so far, I've been very pleased to see that it's gotten some very flattering recommendations from people that I admire a lot on all sides of the debate. So we'll see. Where it's still a new book, so I suspect that more feedback and pushback and criticisms will be coming down the line here, and I welcome that, and hopefully it will continue to push the conversation forward. Yeah.
So what did you learn personally from writing the book?
Boy, well, that's good, because some aspects of the book, when I went into writing the book, I felt very confident about, because they're kind of areas that I specialized in for a long time. And I feel like I had a very solid command of the literature and the issues and stuff like that. For example, cosmological reasoning, arguments for the existence of God from the fact of contingency or metaphysical composition. That's kind of where I've spent a lot of my time. But there's other areas in the book that I had frequently peeked into. I tried to keep up with certain aspects of the debate, but then I began researching to see, okay, is this something I really want to go to the mat on, for example? Some of those would be issues that I just discussed in philosophy of mind and stuff like that, which was always of interest to me, but it wasn't as much of an area of specialization. So I spent a lot of time on just the relevant, literature in those areas. And so I learned a ton, I learned a ton, and some of my, prior commitments and beliefs were sort of revised in that research program. But ultimately what's in the book are the sorts of arguments that I think, yeah, to the best of my ability, when I see how far we can push these sorts of arguments in terms of whether they really do favor classical theism over naturalism is where I wound up. So hopefully there'll be some new stuff for people in there, even if they've been in the apologetics game for a while.
And where can our listeners check the book out?
Yeah, so like you said, it's from published by Sophia, so I know it's on their website somewhere. The Best Argument for God. I usually just, for convenience, just send people to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or wherever they like to get their books. Sure. Yeah.
All right, Pat, is there anything you're working on? Where can our listeners find out more about you, and what are you working on now?
Yeah, thanks. I'm working on a couple more academic articles. I have one was just published in the Review of Metaphysics in December, and that was kind of an obscure topic, but it's testing the thesis of whether essentially ordered causation, whether grounding, which is a contemporary sort of understanding of causality, is essentially ordered causation, which is a theory of causation. It was explored by thinkers like Aquinas and Scotus and stuff like that. And that article might be of interest to people who are curious about concerns of an infinite regress, of whether there could be an infinite regress of things, of contingent causes. It kind of deals with that. I have another article that should be out in a Palgrave volume this summer on the problem of evil, where I actually develop a little bit further some of the stuff we just talked about, but with a particular emphasis on animal suffering, because that's something that people skeptics like to focus on. Is okay, maybe we can explain some evil through moral evil through human ration, but what about all the animals and evolutionary suffering? So I've got some stuff to say on that. And then another article that's in the works, also just taking another look at the logical problem of evil again. So kind of more of the same stuff, but maybe just from a couple different angles mostly.
Okay, great. Well, Pat, thank you for coming on and talking about your book with us. It's been a lot of fun. I learned a lot myself. Hey, God bless you and your work and everything you're doing. I know you do a lot of writing. You just mentioned the articles. You have stuff on Catholic Answers and everything else, and then your own work that you're doing, your podcast. Thanks again for everything you do for us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, William. God bless.
God bless you.